Chapter 6. The Added Law. I pass to your argument on Galatians, chapter 3, verses 17 to 19. On this you say, this law was given 430 years after the promise to Abraham. Could it, therefore, be the same as my commandments, my statutes, and my laws which Abraham kept? They were evidently the moral law, hence this is not. This is an argument that proves too much. It is a reversal of the Campbellite view that the moral law had no existence before it was given upon Mount Sinai. Your argument claims that the moral law was not given upon Mount Sinai, because it existed in the days of Abraham. But it is a fact that God spoke some law from Mount Sinai, and that this event was 430 years after the promise to Abraham. Therefore, your statement that the law given 430 years after the time of Abraham cannot be the moral law because Abraham kept the moral law, amounts to the assertion that the law given upon Mount Sinai was not the moral law. Your argument also, if valid, would prove that the law referred to is not the ceremonial law either, because Abraham had that in substance. He had circumcision, which you say stands for the whole ceremonial law, and he had sacrifices. I think that when you revise your book, that argument at least will have to be left out. You next say, this law was added because of transgressions. The original word signifies to pass by, or over, to transgress, or violate. This law, then, had been added because some other law had been passed by, transgressed, or violated. It was not added to itself because itself had been violated. This would be absurd, if applied to the moral law, for none of us claim there was any more of the moral law really in existence after the Ten Commandments were spoken, than there had been before. They all existed before, though Israel may have been ignorant of portions of them. It seems as though your principal argument is a play upon words. It is not enough to say that a thing is absurd, in order to controvert it. Some things may seem absurd to one person which appear very reasonable to another. Paul says that the preaching of the cross is to some people foolishness, or absurd, and I have often heard people ridicule the idea that the death of one person could atone for the sins of another. They call such an idea absurd, yet to you and me it is perfectly consistent with reason. So when you say that it is absurd to apply the term added to the moral law, you should substantiate your assertion by proof, in order to have it of any value. You say, it could not properly be said that the moral law was appointed 430 years after Abraham, when we see that it existed, and he fully kept it, at that time. This argument has been noticed already, but I will note it a little further. If the law here referred to means the ceremonial law, and your argument just quoted is valid, then it precludes the possibility of there being any ceremonial law in the time of Abraham, but Abraham had the essential parts of the ceremonial law, although that law had not been formally given. If you deny that Abraham had the ceremonial law, and insist that that law was not given until 430 years after his time, then I would like to ask what remedial system there was before the Exodus? You say that the ceremonial law was added because of transgressions, that is, as a remedial system. Then why was it not added as soon as the transgression was committed, instead of 2,500 years later? I claim that the remedial system entered immediately after the fall, and for proof I cite you to the offering of Abel. Your argument would put off the remedial system until the Exodus. You may say that at that time the ceremonial law was given more formally and circumstantially than before, very good, but if that argument will apply to the ceremonial law, as it undeniably will, why will it not apply equally to the moral law? You cannot deny that the moral law was given at Sinai, although it had been known since the creation. Why was it given then? Because it had never been formally announced. So far as we know, no copy of it had ever been written, and the great mass of the people were almost totally ignorant in regard to it. You, yourself, say that Israel may have been ignorant of portions of the moral law, and this is undoubtedly true. Then there is abundant reason why it should have been given at that time, because of transgressions. If all the people had known and obeyed the law, there would have been no necessity for its promulgation on Sinai, but because they were ignorant of its requirements, and had transgressed it, it was necessary that it should then be given as it was. But you say that it is not proper to apply the term added to the moral law. The Bible itself must decide that matter. In the fifth chapter of Deuteronomy, Moses rehearses to the children of Israel the circumstances of the giving of the law. Verses 5 to 21 contain the substance of the Ten Commandments, and of these Moses says in the 22nd verse, "These words the Lord spake unto all your assembly in the mount out of the midst of the fire, of the cloud, and of the thick darkness, with a great voice, and he added no more." The term added, in this verse, is in the Septuagint, exactly the same as that rendered added in Galatians, chapter 3, verse 19. The Hebrew word is the same that is rendered added in Genesis, chapter 30, verse 24. That it has unmistakable reference in Deuteronomy, chapter 5, verse 22, to the moral law, and to that alone, no one can deny. I care not whether you render it added, spoken, or promulgated, it makes no difference. In Hebrews, chapter 12, verses 18 and 19, we have unmistakable reference to the voice of God speaking the law from Sinai, and the request of the people that God should not speak to them any more, and the words, "which voice they that heard entreated that the word should not be spoken to them any more." Here the word rendered spoken is the same as that rendered added in Galatians, chapter 3, verse 19, and Deuteronomy, chapter 5, verse 22. If we chose we might render it, "they entreated that the word should not be added to them any more," and then we would have a uniform rendering. Or we might render it uniformly spoken, and then we would read in Deuteronomy, that the Lord spoke all those words in the mount, out of the midst of the fire, etc., with a great voice, and he spoke no more, and this would be the exact truth and a good rendering. And likewise for uniformity, we might justly render Galatians, chapter 5, verse 19, "it was spoken because of transgressions." Or we might take the word in Deuteronomy, chapter 5, verse 22, in the same sense in which it is used in Genesis, chapter 30, verse 24, and the same idea would appear. When Rachel said, "God shall add to me another son," it was the same as though she had said, "God will give me another son." So the meaning in Deuteronomy, chapter 5, verse 22, is that after the Lord had given them the commandments recorded in the preceding verses, he gave them no more. It seems to me very reasonable to apply the term added to the moral law, and whether it is reasonable or not, I have certainly quoted two texts besides Galatians, chapter 3, verse 19, which apply it so. But you cannot find in the Bible a single instance of the use of the word added, as applied to the ceremonial law, to substantiate your view on Galatians, chapter 3, verse 19. Deuteronomy, chapter 5, verse 22, plainly says that the Ten Commandments were spoken by the Lord, and that nothing but the Ten Commandments was spoken, or given, or added. Galatians, chapter 3, verse 19, tells us why they were spoken. It was because of transgressions, that is, because people were largely ignorant of the law. We may not play upon the word added and use it in a mathematical sense, but must necessarily use it in the sense of declaring or speaking. There was no more moral law after God spoke it from Sinai than there was before, but it was certainly known a great deal better than it was before, and there was less excuse for sin than there was before. In the preceding verses, the apostle has spoken of the promise to Abraham and the covenant made to him. The statement that that covenant was confirmed in Christ shows plainly that the covenant to Abraham confirmed the forgiveness of sins through Christ. But the forgiveness of sin necessarily implies a knowledge of sin. Only the righteous can be heirs of the promise, and a knowledge of sin and righteousness can only be obtained through the moral law. Therefore, the giving of the law, in a more specific manner than ever before, was necessary, in order that the people might be partakers of the blessings promised to Abraham. The very same thing is stated in Romans, chapter 5, verse 20. Moreover, the law entered that the offense might abound, and I never knew any Seventh-day Adventist to have any trouble in applying that to the moral law, yet it is certainly as difficult a text as Galatians, chapter 3, verse 10. The word rendered entered is, literally, came in. The Revised Version has it, came in beside. But the moral law existed before the days of Moses, as is evident from verses 13 and 14 of the same chapter, and also from the expression in the same verse, that the offense might abound, showing that sin, the transgression of the law, existed before the law came in. Although the law existed in all its force before the Exodus, yet it came in, entered, was spoken or given, or added at that time. And why? That the offense might abound, that is, that sin by the commandment might become exceeding sinful, that what was sin before might the more plainly be seen to be sin. Thus it entered, or was added, because of transgressions. If it had not been for transgressions, there would have been no necessity for the law to enter at Sinai. Why did it enter? Because of transgressions? That the offense might abound, in order to make sin seem greater than ever before, so that men might be driven to the superabounding grace of God, as manifested in Christ. And so it became a schoolmaster, pedagogue, to bring men to Christ, in order that they might be justified by faith, and be made the righteousness of God in Him. And so it is stated later that the law is not against the promises of God. It works in harmony with the promise, for without it, the promise would be of no effect. And this, most emphatically, attests the perpetuity of the law. I do not care for the opinions of commentators, except as they state in a clearer form that which has already been proved from the Bible, but as you in your pamphlet seem to have placed considerable reliance upon the opinion of commentators, it may not be profitless to quote a few here. I do it, however, not because I think they add anything to the argument, but simply as an offset to your quotations, and because they possibly state the case a little more clearly than I have done. Professor Boise, in his critical notes on the Greek text of Galatians, says on this text, because of the transgressions indicates, therefore, this idea, to give a knowledge of transgressions, to make plainly clear and distinct what were actual transgressions of the divine requirements. He also says, in keeping with this idea, and perhaps implied, is the interpretation, to restrain transgressions. And he cites Erasmus, Ilshausen, Neander, De Wet, Ewald, Luther, Bengel, and others, as holding the same view. If the opinions of commentators are to decide this matter, I think that the moral law will come out ahead. Dr. Barnes says on the expression, because of transgressions, on account of transgressions, or with reference to them. The meaning is that the law was given to show the true nature of transgression, or to show what was sin. It was not to reveal a way of justification, but it was to disclose the true nature of sin, to deter men from committing it, to declare its penalty, to convince men of it, and thus to be ancillary to, and preparatory to, the work of redemption through the Redeemer. This is the true account of the law of God as given to apostate men, and this use of the law still exists. And Dr. Clark says, "It was given that we might know our sinfulness, and the need we stood in of the mercy of God. The law is the right line, the straight edge that determines the obliquity of our conduct." See the notes on Romans, chapter 4, verse 15, and especially on Romans, chapter 5, verse 20, where the subject is largely discussed and the figure explained. Your argument against the moral law being added, because of transgressions, will apply with equal force against the moral law, having entered that the offense might abound. If you claim that Galatians, chapter 3, verse 19, cannot apply to the moral law, then you must claim also that Romans, chapter 5, verse 20, does not apply to that law. I quote further from your pamphlet, from the paragraph ending at the top of page 44, "It would be absurd to suppose that this law was added to itself. It does apply reasonably to another law, brought in because the one previously existing had been violated. A law cannot be transgressed unless it exists, for where no law is, there is no transgression." I have already shown the force of the term, added. I have never claimed that any law was added to itself, or that any mathematical process is referred to by the word rendered, added. What do you mean by saying a law cannot be transgressed until it exists? You seem to imply that the moral law did not exist so that it could be transgressed before it was given upon Mount Sinai. I know you do not believe this, and yet in another paragraph it is implied still more plainly. I will again quote Romans, chapter 5, verse 20, "Moreover, the law entered, that the offense might abound. But where sin abounded, grace did much more abound." This law unmistakably is the moral law, yet you might say it is impossible that it should be the moral law, because offenses existed before the law here spoken of entered, and where no law is there is no transgression, and that therefore the law which here entered was some other law. But you would not argue that here. You would claim as I do, that the meaning of the text is that the law entered, or was given, in order that sin might appear in its true enormity. As Paul elsewhere says, "Sin by the commandment became exceeding sinful." The moral law existed from creation, and long before. The patriarchs had a knowledge of it, and also all the antediluvians and the Sodomites, because they were counted sinners. Yet it did not exist in written form, and those who were not in immediate connection with God could not have that perfect knowledge of the law which would show them the full heinousness of sin. They could know that the things which they committed were wrong, but they could not realize their full enormity, and especially was this the case when the Israelites came from Egyptian bondage. But God had made a covenant with Abraham, and had promised wonderful things, but only on condition of perfect righteousness through Christ, and if men ever attained to this perfect righteousness, they must have the law in its fullest extent, and must know that many things were sinful, which they might previously have thought were harmless. So the law entered, that the offense might abound, and because the offense abounded, and men saw their depravity, they found that grace superabounded to cover their sins. The case is so plain, and the argument in Galatians, chapter 3, verse 19, is so plainly parallel, that I marvel how anybody who has any just conception of the relation of the law and the gospel can question it for a moment. Again on page 44 I read, the moral law is referred to as the one transgressed. But the added law, of which Paul is speaking, made provision for the forgiveness of these transgressions in figure, till the real sacrifice should be offered. Your misapplication of the word added I have already sufficiently noticed, but there is an idea expressed in the quotation just made which I am sorry to see has of late been taught to some extent. And that is that in the so-called Jewish dispensation forgiveness of sins was only figurative. Your words plainly indicate that there was no real forgiveness of sins until Christ, the real sacrifice, was offered. If that were so, I would like to inquire how Enoch and Elijah got to heaven. Were they taken there with their sins and forgiven? Had they been in heaven for 2,000 or 3,000 years before their sins were forgiven? The very fact that they were taken to heaven is sufficient evidence that their sins were really pardoned. When David says, "Blessed is he whose transgressions are forgiven, whose sins are covered," he means just what Paul did when he used the same words. David said to the Lord, "Thou forgivest the iniquity of my sin." That was no sham forgiveness. And it was expressly declared that if a soul should sin against any of the commandments of the Lord, he should offer his sacrifice, and his sins should be forgiven him. There was no virtue in the sacrifice, which was typical, yet the pardon was as real as any that has ever been given since the crucifixion. How could this be? Simply because Christ is the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. That he should offer himself as a sacrifice was promised to our first parents in Eden, and confirmed to Abraham by an oath from God, and therefore, by virtue of that promise, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and all who wished, could receive as much virtue from the blood of Christ as we can. That forgiveness was real is shown by the fact that Abel, by his offering, received witness that he was righteous. But there can be no righteousness that has not been preceded by forgiveness. If the pardon were figurative, then the righteousness must also have been figurative. But Abel and Noah and Abraham, and others, were really righteous. They had the perfect righteousness of faith. Therefore they must have had actual forgiveness. This is further shown from the fact that forgiveness of sins must precede all righteousness. For there can be no righteousness without faith, and faith always brings pardon.